Live from across Europe, this is Previously in Europe, a podcast of what's previously in Europe. Hosted by me, Hugh O'Brien, in London. My beautiful co-host, Kieran Dold, in Berlin. Say hello, Kieran.
I'm still sweaty.
Yes. So we are recording this for... This is a Patreon bonus episode. We are recording this on Saturday, June 15th, 2019, the year of our Lord. For some context of what's happening on June 15th, it is hot in Berlin. I am eagerly awaiting tomorrow's first Conservative Party leadership debate.
Ugh.
To decide arbitrarily who my new Prime Minister is. Future people in a month from now listening to this who aren't our glorious Patreon supporters. How'd it go? Did it go fine? I'm sure it's fine. I'm not worried about it. So this episode we were going to discuss our proposals for how we would reform the EU and how they compare to some other like grand sweeping plans, which we will get into for how you would reform the EU that are much touted.
Yes.
Namely, we were going to discuss Papa Macron and his... I feel like the reason we came up with this as a topic was because there was a lot... There was like a continuous stream of articles... like throughout Macron's entire presidency, which is just like Macron's agenda is like big EU reforms he wants to do, but then the more like once you look into it beyond a surface level, unless like no one is talking about this in English, they don't have like a lot of detail. It's very like vague things he wants to do before he released that open letter to the European people thing.
Yeah, and that didn't really manifest in anything as well. Like it was. He wasn't able to, like, actually rally a movement.
No, so. Well, I think as we'll talk about now, it's because a lot of his reforms were bad.
Yeah.
not things people want. I thought it was interesting because it's framed as, like, this is his, like, big thing. Is he wants to, like, do lots of EU changes. And if the EU election doesn't go well for him, that's bad because he won't get to do any of his EU changes.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, would you know if he had done any of his EU changes at this point?
Yeah, right? They're all...
Yeah.
For all,
I know, they might, like, in a couple of months, he might, and the commission is, like, the new commission's in place and stuff, Macron could just start claiming that things they're doing is stuff that he came up with, and just be like, yeah, that was my plan all along, it's great they're doing it.
Yeah, kind of like the situation where he kind of came along and said, I'm in favor of EU minimum wage, even though, like, other parties have been saying it for ages.
Yeah. So we talked about his open letter in a previous episode, which is linked in the show notes, in case you want us to go, like, you want to hear the me going through point by point what Macron's talking about and Kieran getting progressively more and more angry.
Ah, fun times.
but generally, it was mostly, like, economic tweaks he wanted to do, and it largely, kind of, like, the analysis of it largely was, like, he's just describing a two-speed Europe, where he wants to have an EU finance minister who decides centralized fiscal policy, which isn't necessarily a bad idea, but it's like he's bigging this up as like a big, like massive thing that he's come up with, which it's like a lot of people agree with him on that.
Yeah.
Via that, he wants a joint Eurozone budget, which again, a lot of people like agree with him on that because of the problem of they have a common currency that like is, you know, liable to the whims of any individual member state doing something crazy or like having economic problems, and then they're not there's no, other than giving them money via loans, there's no like mechanism by which you can fix that. You're just kind of reliant on a lot of separate parties who don't really interact very closely. And then he wants to make like a new bit of bureaucracy that's tasked with overseeing block-wide economic policy. So for instance, they could set like there is already EU like minimum spending limits, but you could do other mechanisms in that vein. And then he wants to take away the like oversight from the European Council and Commission, I guess, and give it to this new body that is in charge of it, like, I guess, a finance ministry of some description.
Yeah.
But he hasn't really described, like, what that would be or how big it would be or what would be needed. I guess it's for more of a later details thing.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, like, there's a lot of that stuff. And then he kind of wanted, like, Europe first trade stuff, But it seemed a lot of that was like complaints about how the EU Commission keeps preventing mergers between giant French and German businesses to form like European monopolies. He kind of wants more of a from that perspective, he wants to think like of Europe as one country for the purpose of global trade, and then enact competition policy on that, in that logic, which is kind of sketchy in my opinion.
Yeah, it's this weird thing of like centralizing Europe, but only from the perspective of like finance.
Yeah,
which is weird. It's like, I guess we kind of like this idea of what if we just gave the central bank in your country like more powers and more oversight, and you know, or less oversight, I should say. So it's like, yeah, but these positions are not elected and not really democratic.
No.
So yeah.
Yeah, he like from that perspective, he kind of he wants there to be like weird, financial globbing together, and then as an aside to that, like have kind of liberalize internal EU competition policy to make the EU more competitive globally. But this is kind of like around scary China or is going to crush all of our European like giant multinationals.
It's like, yeah.
I mean. Maybe. I'm not sure. Then he wants... he had loads of weird tech ideas around. He wants there to be, like... He wants more European supervision of digital platforms and have some sort of way that you'd penalize them for not being transparent and, you know, fake news, yada yada. And to do this, he wants to start a new European agency for the protection of democracies. Which, again... Uh-huh.
That's just like Russiagate panic, basically.
Yeah, so this was in like this was last year. So I mean, full swing of that stuff. And again, it's unclear like what that would cost, what it would actually do, other than like just prod at Google and Facebook and other ad providers. I mean, it's not like a terrible idea. It's just kind of like unclear and. A lot of people would argue like the commission could do that already. They don't need to create a new like thing, like a department for it.
Yeah, I also just like the name of like protecting European democracies, but not, you know, the giant centralized financial institution I want to create. That's fine.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely not an affront to democracy.
Yeah, and then a lot of other stuff that requires spending more money, and which people aren't really going to do. And then carbon neutrality stuff, which I think is not like extreme enough, but is again like it's like a policy. It's not like a reform. It's more of just like his vision stuff.
The carbon neutral stuff is getting really annoying now.
Yeah, I think the main takeaway from like Macron's position generally is that a lot of his things that are touted as reforms are on the financial end, and then he wants to add additional bureaucracies to do new things that he thinks the EU doesn't do yet, and then the rest of it is all policy stuff that is achievable via the current mechanisms, and a lot of it is achievable nationally, but the EU actually might be to the left of him on a lot of that stuff, so it's probably better to do it via the EU and get something better. But yeah. There's I thought it was odd that he's always brought up as like big reforms he wants, whereas they tend to be mostly financial instrument reforms.
Yeah, well, that's because it's kind of the whole like if all you have is a hammer, all problems look like a nail type of situation, because he is like an economics guy. He was like formerly economics finance minister under Hollande's government.
Yeah, he was the economy minister. And like his background is all banking stuff as well. Like it's
He has this view of the world that like if everything in terms of economy was the way I wanted it to be, like everything would be fucking roses.
Yeah, everything else would sort itself out. Which I mean, you know, sure. Let's let him. He's gonna have a go at it.
Yeah, like,
he's already stop, president of France.
We can't stop him.
I think he might stop himself by suggesting something that everyone's gonna be like, no, we don't, like nobody else in Europe wants this bit of it.
I mean, like having a tax increase on petrol, maybe.
Yeah. That worked out great.
Just that just that, but more. Just let him wild out.
Yeah, I mean, like, it seems to be going fine. The in response to this, AKK, Merkel's quote unquote successor, who I don't think will last another year. She famously at the time gave like a big response of like how she would reform the EU as like a counterpoint to Macron's vision. But this was mostly just about migration and protecting borders and like how the EU should be focused on that. And then she also said some good things, like she wants to get rid of the Strasbourg Parliament and then tax EU officials more. Because a lot of EU officials are like tax exempt.
Get rid of Strasbourg is definitely like the EU equivalent of let's hear it for the troops.
Yeah. It is, except if you're in France, which is like more time in Strasbourg and develop the building more.
Let's nuke Belgium. Yeah, you're right. But it is very like, it's just such an easy thing to say to like be like win over people like EU reforms. Everyone under the sun is saying this except for France.
But especially in Germany, like the Germans and the CDU especially are just like, save money and screw over the French at once.
I think also it's worth pointing out that like half of France is also saying this. I think there are like French people who are like above their nation and can say, actually, yeah, the Strasbourg Parliament is dumb.
Yeah, it's very stupid. And then also Macron gave some weird thing of like he'd have citizens assemblies of some description. It's unclear what he meant by it. He was like, he wants there to be like a citizens input constitutional convention to have a new constitution for Europe. But in suggesting that he doesn't give any policy ideas.
No, yeah, but like that's so my general take on this is that constitutional conventions are good in a broad stroke, but I think everyone would think that, and that's the problem about like not specifying how they'd work. It's a kind of thing of like, yeah, I love democracy. It's like, yeah, but what version of it?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think like the no matter how they work, I think you'd find a lot of people in the EPP wouldn't want a constitutional convention, because
so here'd be my take on it. It's not necessarily the constitutional convention that's the problem. It's the how the people with actual power deal with it after the fact, because like that was the thing in Ireland where we had the constitutional convention. It ended up being like way more progressive than we thought it was going to be. It ended up being way more progressive than the current Fine Gael centre-right government wanted it or was willing to handle, and it was all just ended up being concessions. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, it wasn't the constitutional convention that had any real power.
Mm-hmm.
It would still have to be filtered through this authority, which I think that's probably how Macron envisions it as well. But I still have final say. Like what if the constitutional convention came along and said, actually, all the rest of Macron's plans are absolute shite? I don't think he'd handle that well. He's not a very chill guy.
Well, I mean, he could just construct it the way he constructed his grand national tour, which is only allow
mayors to speak.
Yeah, and like pre-vetted questions. Like, anyway, it's not. I think that's the premise of this topic was largely, we're going to spend lots of time looking into exactly what Macron wants to change and argue why like some of that might be good and some of that might be bad, but like we don't like the most of it, and here's our ideas. But I think what we found was, there's not a lot of detail here at all. And
no.
A lot of his changes are like, I want to start an agency for this thing. It's like, well, that's not really what we thought you meant when you said, when it was like Macron, he's like the big change in Europe guy.
So remember Penelope Gate and like how everyone, like how it took down your guy from Les Républicains, but basically it was also kind of revealed that like a lot of politicians in France just do this. I think this is maybe like Macron's brain genius way to get around the scandal of just like, yes, I'll hire my friends and family, but if I put them in an EU institution, it'll be outside of French jurisdiction.
Macron doesn't have any friends.
Fair enough. Okay. So, you're right. There was very little content for us to like actually specifically critique Macron's plan.
Is a good thing.
Yeah, we're not going to do like, and this isn't the end of the episode. It's not just going to be 15 minutes. We did kind of go through like everything the EU is as an institution, and then kind of like talked about what it would do. We also looked at some other places that talk about pan-European reform, like Volt and DM25, and surprise, surprise, Volt didn't really have much of substance, but DM25 does, and we kind of took some things there, we added our own kind of twists and had criticisms, but
So we again, in the same way talking about Macron stuff, I tried to filter out stuff that was like a policy and not kind of a change you would make as much as possible. Some of this stuff is policies, but you would need to do structural changes to do it. But it's less of the commissioner for competition should just ignore the mergers I like. Less of that. It's more of things we would change and why they would be a good idea. So we go through our short term to long term ones.
We've separated this into short term and long term. Short term is defined by could be done in one commission cycle.
Yeah, so something that would take 5 years, or you could just, if you had the right commissioners in place, just start doing it immediately.
Yeah,
And it would need very little actual change. It's stuff that kind of would be easy to convince. You just need enough. You'd need enough of the council, the heads of government and commissioners on board, and then you could just start doing this.
Yeah.
So number one, make the transparency register mandatory. So. In the EU part, so the EU gets a lot of flack for having a lot of lobbyists in it, which is a fair assessment. But there is a transparency register, which is, it's not mandatory, but it's basically strongly implied that you should be on it if you're a lobbyist. And by being on it, then your meetings with EU officials get recorded somewhere. And if you just actually kept the current structure of it largely the way it is and made it mandatory for, so basically say you can't get into the EU Parliament at all if you're not on the transparency register and you're not a and you work for anybody that's not the EU itself, then you have to be on this. Would be a very, very straightforward thing that you could change, and then that's your problem solved. I would if I had to go to the EU for any reason, I'd be happy to put myself on I visited the EU list and here are the people I met with, and here's what my vast corporate funding comes from.
I just like the idea of I bought this one MEP a steak dinner so that he could be so podcasts sure are cool.
I mean, I'm dying for that. Again, since this is a Patreon episode, I should mention that one of our Patreon goals is, once we have enough money, me and Karen are just going to go to Brussels once a year and harass some people.
Yes. But in a nice and jaunty way, not in the way that could get us arrested by one of the weird three levels of Belgian police that exist.
No, I'd probably approach some MEPs I like beforehand and see if they'd meet with us. crazy like that. And then I'd be happy to go on Transparency Register as a self-funded interest group.
Oh, God. Moving on to our next one, end tax havens.
Yeah. So, again, this would be very... Again, it's something that, effectively by convention, no one has made this an official rule. But it would be very straightforward to just bring in a minimum corporation tax in the EU, and that would actually solve this problem largely. But they're already trying to solve the problem of what the previous EU Commission viewed as illegal. For EU rules reasons, tax deals, where both Ireland and Luxembourg are notorious for this, for making deals with companies to get them to move there, where they end up effectively paying no corporation tax, even though there is a corporation tax in that country, and it is under the premise of attracting jobs, but the tax receipts they're giving up are way, way, way in excess of any jobs that are ever going to be created.
In the Irish situation, I think there was a good study that showed that there's this Irish company, a large Irish company, Kerry Group, which, if you know, makes Kerry Gold Butter. They hire more people than all the US tech companies in Ireland combined. That are usually the receiving beneficiary of these tax deals.
You could argue that, they weren't going to move there otherwise. It's but the net bad for the EU by you making this deal was somewhere in the region of like $10 billion for one of the you're getting into like ridiculous money at that point. It's not a good faith argument to say like, oh, we created like another 1,000 jobs in Dublin. It's like, that's nice, but you really fucked over everyone in the EU effectively by doing this.
Well, like, and also you fucked over everyone who doesn't get those 1,000 jobs. Like the net benefit of like that corporation tax coming in to the rest of like Irish or Luxembourgish society is like usually a lot better. Also, it's this weird self-defeating thing of like, well, can't we just make our own industries and like make our own companies?
Mm.
There's this kind of like self-hating logic. Like, I know Luxembourg is mostly like holding companies for massive corporations across Europe, but Ireland is trying to attract industries that are very consumer-facing and people kind of view as being very good and productive and did cool things.
Yeah.
But it kind of like neuters the idea that, I guess, like a good comparison is like Sweden. I think a lot of Irish people really don't entertain the thought that Ireland could have its own equivalent to hate, like to an IKEA.
Mm.
That like we could have actually that kind of impact on the world.
Yeah.
When there's like really no reason why we couldn't.
I don't know, man. Yeah, you can buy Kerry Group butter in Germany. Just saying.
Yeah. So that's the closest thing, I guess. But even then, the other side of this as well, of ending tax havens within the EU, is also exerting pressure on the tax havens that exist outside the EU, because most of the other tax havens, I think it's most of the tax havens in the world, are effectively dependent on the EU or like an EU member state.
The number of them that are like former colonies or still connected, or like the UK has a lot of crown dependencies and stuff that are tax havens. Are like under the purview of the UK government technically, and they could do something about it, but they've chosen not to for obvious reasons.
Yeah. So you have those crown dependency things with the UK. You have similar situations with like France and their various islands across the globe. And then lastly would be Europe's microstates, which all of them are dependent on the EU effectively. Like most of them use the euro as an example, like Monaco and Andorra use the euro. I think Liechtenstein uses the Swiss franc, so that gets into a difficult situation, but Liechtenstein still kind of operates as like a place for German and Austrian millionaires and billionaires to shuffle around money.
I'm just saying, if we got rid of all the tax havens except for Liechtenstein, Liechtenstein is so inaccessible. this would solve a large chunk of the deal. With Liechtenstein later, it's fine.
I'll take this as a win.
I'm happy to change this to easily end tax havens via some small structural changes, except for Liechtenstein, because they can do what they want. That's what I'm saying.
Moving on to our next policy position.
It's a structural change.
Okay, structural change, yes.
Some short-term changes to migration policies. So again, via like the... There's like effectively a convention that by the Dublin Agreement... The refugees are supposed to be dealt with in their like first country
of arrival.
So if you had a different mechanism in place, then so that creates a problem of like Italy would just like to deport everyone who comes into it currently. And then you end up with people getting deported to unsafe territories, like back to Libya, where they're not originally from, but where they happen to be last, and you're just like kicking the can away. And then you also have this problem, like Germany deports people to unsafe territories as well. But I think a large part of it is around the way there is no centralized migration structure. And I think if you created one, you could then start changing things like this quite easily. Because if the migration was handled centrally, then you wouldn't have Salvini's come to power and is now not letting boats dock that have migrants on them.
It's a rubbish situation.
And one of the things that they do now is, you know, work out a coordinated way to give money to foreign governments or make deals with, say, Turkey to come up with like reciprocal return return arrangements in exchange for like EU money and travel arrangements. You're like, well, that's kind of like a bullshit. Like, you're literally trading the safety of some people in exchange for visas for Turkish people. Just like, this is pretty dark.
Yeah, and again, I think we've talked about it several times in the podcast, but like some countries are considering doing something very similar with Libya, which is in a much worse situation than Turkey is.
There's active funding that was going to the quote-unquote Libyan Coast Guard, which was just one of the governments in Libya that they decided was the one they wanted to help fund. But effectively, they were like, this is just their navy. Like, there is no Coast Guard. This is...
Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous suggesting that there is like an official like large scale coast guard that you're giving money to. You're just like effectively funding one of the factions in a civil war because you don't like the migrants are using Libya as a stopping point.
Yeah, and then that whole situation was absolutely messed up. So stop that would be an interesting way. The other side of this is, like, a handful of these countries that are currently unstable are former colonial holdings. And in general, the idea we kind of came up with was, like, reparations to former colonies. However, this does lead into, and we recognize this is a problem of, like, how do we actually guarantee that money goes to things that will improve the nature of those societies rather than, like, lining the pockets of someone at the very tippy top. Which is a problem within our own countries, don't get me wrong. But yeah, it's this weird situation of like, how do we help Libya become a place that like Libyans are proud of and want to live in and stuff like that, without resorting to like, one, closing ourselves off to Libya, and to just enriching one very weird and very corrupt person in Libya.
I think Libya is not a great example because it's like it's not like a relatively recent like colonial power that's like it has a very different history. But there's like the common thing that does get brought up is like, well, it's the problem isn't Libyan migrants running to the EU. It's people who are going through Libya from the rest of Africa, often from countries that have enormous problems, partially due to their colonial history and funding structural like infrastructure and stuff in those countries might be a good way of improving the life in those countries to help fix that problem. And similar to the, well, if you don't farm this what is a Europe-wide problem out to the individual countries that happen to be on the edge of Europe, if you did this centrally as well, you wouldn't get into a squabble of, well, they're your former colony, why aren't you, you need to pay for all this money. It's like, well, the EU is acknowledging overall that there is, an increase in migration, and if you want to slow that down, that is the way you should probably be doing it as like a long-term solution. If you're basically like saying there shouldn't be so many refugees, like, yeah, people shouldn't have to like move from where they are, and like you only have so much control over individual civil wars, but there's a lot of like quote-unquote economic migrants that, not in the sense that you shouldn't let them in, but in the sense that, well, there's a reason they're economic migrants. It's not like their country is coincidentally has problems.
Oh god. Okay.
Fix the euro. That sounds straightforward.
Yes.
We wanted to defer to European Spring, which was the DiEM25 European election campaign kind of coordination group thing. So I'll just read out there, fix the euro a bit, because this is actually not that in a lot of ways this is like stuff that Macron would like, which is quite funny. And it's a very like economist centric approach, which makes sense because of a lot of the people involved in DiEM25.
Yes.
So it's, we will end Europe's public and private debt crisis. Sure. I'll have lots of critiques in the middle of this. The ECB will terminate the Eurozone's public debt crisis by means of a limited public debt conversion program. Sure, that sounds fine. Combined bank resolution and common deposit insurance scheme administered by the ECB and ESM will end the banking crisis, including new protections for all Europeans struggling with mortgage debt. So, like, a lot of that is you could make the ECB more powerful, or but in the sense of it doesn't really make sense if you're going to have a deposit protection scheme to have each of the Euro countries running their own, because you then have the problem of, well, this country, you know, they had some problems with their individual local banks, you know, dealing out loans badly. And yes, you can blame that country individually for not having, like, better oversight, or you could argue that, well, if it's going to have this big an impact on our common currency, maybe we should all agree on a common rule and just have all our stuff run centrally. So instead of basically, using Greece as an example, if when the Greek banking system collapsed, instead of the Eurozone and IMF saying, okay, cool, we're going to loan you the money to bail your banks out, if the ECB was just like, that's fine, the deposit protection isn't run by Greece anyway, it's run by the ECB, so we can bail out which banks we want and absorb which banks we want to, like, make sure no one has lost their, like, you know, current account and savings.
Yeah.
The part of the logic around this is, like, there's an increase in banks that do not operate, like, their customers are not in the country that they primarily operate from. So, like, one example of this is that bank Revolut, which is one of those, like, app-based car, like, it's a current account you can get that is, like, operates just like a normal debit card would, but they have no physical banks. But they're based in Lithuania, I think, is where they're, like, that's the central bank they're connected to, and there was a lot of comparisons made with that, with how that setup works now in Iceland, because their holdings are more than are now more than the GDP of, I think it's Lithuania. I need to double check which country it is.
A Baltic country, is it?
It's one of the Baltic countries. I don't remember which one.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so their GDP wouldn't cover a deposit protection scheme for Revolut anymore. Right. Because most of their business is spread across the rest of Europe. Like, they operate in France, the UK. It's not like as in their deposits far exceed what their central thing could do. And so part of that is because of the common currency. Obviously, the UK doesn't have it, but, like, part of it is that, like, people don't interact with single country banks. So why do you have a single country system for it? It's kind of a bit silly. Idiotic. The rest of this is parallel digital public payment systems will bolster member states and be brought together into a European clearing union that resembles the Eurozone and eliminates the threat of catastrophic costs of a euro exit. Yeah, this is kind of getting more into the weeds of, like, what would happen if a country had to leave the euro and stuff, because you would have kicked someone out. I'm just, like, creating internal this seems like a smart reform of this is the common, like, internal wonky argument around the euro when it was, you know, being created, was you can't having a common currency but no common fiscal policy at all other than like some debt limits doesn't really make sense long term, because you're going to have some sort of recession somewhere, or perhaps a worldwide banking crisis.
No, that would never happen. What are you talking about?
once in a generation, or twice, or three or four times, we'll see.
Every 4 years.
Four more years.
Oh god, yeah. So that's the euro stuff, and then we go nicely into what Ciarán cares most about, which is, like, EU election reform.
This is what I care most about as well.
That's fair. So two things, or, like, two main things that kind of go hand in hand, which is, and it's very important you listen to my wording here. Mm-hmm. Put the EU parties on the voting ballots as well as the local party. As local party, we mean the national party. Yeah. And on top of that, get rid of parliament groupings, because they're really just parties. So we should probably explain for anyone who doesn't know the difference between the party and the grouping. A good example of this is the United European Left / Nordic Green Left is a grouping that is largely made up of two parties, One is called the United European Left, or the, I think it's just called the European Left now.
Yep.
And the other one is called the Nordic Green Left.
Yep.
And these are, yeah, these are parties of parties. They contain the actual, like, national parties, but they then group together and give themselves a new name, which I think is dumb and shouldn't exist anymore, basically, in a more clear-cut system. It should just be European parties in the parliament, and they're more likely to work together, or it would probably force some of them to, like, actually, like, coalesce. Yeah, that's kind of where I land on this.
And this gets into something we mean to talk about, which is one of our wonderful, wonderful Patreon donors suggested in our suggestion box, which you can suggest things in,
yes,
to talk about non-inscrits.
Non-inscrits, yeah.
Non-inscrits, which are basically, they're the... So this gets into the complication of the difference between European parties and groupings in the European Parliament, where... Non-inscrits are non-attached members, what that translates to, which are members of the European Parliament who don't sit in one of the political groupings. And this is, you know, usually due to a variety of reasons, but basically to be a political grouping, you need to have, 24 MEPs?
25 MEPs, and they have to come from 7 different countries.
Yeah, which is, they need to come from at least a quarter of all the countries. That number would change if there was different numbers in the European Union.
Yeah.
So that's how they've done that. Which I don't think is, like, unreasonable, but it then creates this weird division where, so some of the non-inscrits can be in European-wide parties. They just don't meet the threshold for a grouping, so they don't get to be called a grouping, which is confusing. There was at one point they had a technical group of independents, which, like, has since been, they basically, the European Parliament was basically like, you can't just form together a glob of miscellaneous people. You need to have, like, a common ideology of some description, or, like, a common position platform. You can't just form together in order to take advantage of speaking time rules. I think our perspective on this was, if you got you can get rid of the groupings and then instead transfer most of the groupings rules to the parties, and basically say, like in any other parliament, your party is one thing. It's not like our party is made up of multiple separate parties that are... Well, that does happen on some national levels. I think on a European level, it's silly. And it creates a lot of, like, this kind of stuff where you have people who are, like, not technically in a grouping and therefore don't get some stuff. Or people who, like, quit other groupings. So, like, Jean-Marie Le Pen was a non-inscrit.
Yes, she was when she first joined. Yeah.
No, her father.
Oh, sorry. Yes, of course.
Because he fell out with the National Front but was still an MEP.
Yeah. It's this kind of thing where, like, we're not necessarily against the extra speaking rights and stuff like that that's awarded to the groupings. It's just, you get rid of the mechanism of the groupings and just say, if your party meets this description,
yeah,
like, you have 25 MEPs at least, and they're from 7 different countries, a quarter of the countries.
Yeah.
Then you unlock those rights, but the party still gets to exist. Beyond that, like, you can still have the party, you can still make yourself a website, whatever else that's involved.
Apply for funding and stuff. They apply for funding to put on events and things related to their, like, political cause. From the EU. So, like, so if you look at the list of, like, current inscrits, like, the general description of like, what they are, which is kind of people on the fringes of either side of the spectrum. So it's, like, mostly far-right parties, but then there are some people who just don't get on with the other side of other side. So, for instance, like, the two Communist Party MEPs
from Greece were
non-inscrits because they don't get on with anyone, really.
They don't get on with the United European Left, so they're kind of pushed out.
Yeah.
So most of it, you're right, is, like, far right, and therefore don't really, they're beyond the purview, supposedly, of the, like, far right groupings. Mm-hmm. Golden Dawn is a classic example of that. The other example is, this often happens, like, mid parliament, like mid commission cycle,
yeah,
that people get pushed out because they just had like an internal disagreement,
yeah,
and they become a non-inscrit because they've effectively left the party on a national level, usually.
So there's, there's some people, so there's like one of the civic platform people from Poland was expelled from the EPP, but is still, I'm pretty sure, still a civic platform member.
Right.
So there are some exceptions to that, but yeah, that is often the way. Or like the, if your grouping implodes, like, so some of the UKIP members are, were in the AFDD, but are now non-inscrits.
Yeah.
As the parliament currently exists, part of the way this is confusing is part of the problem with the grouping party divide is that it's like, so effectively they're like independent members in the parliament. They're like, yes, but we've complicated things drastically in a way that seems almost intentionally confusing. And on the face of it seems like a fair way of apportioning funds. But then you're like, well, why do you separate the parties and the, and this, because you're basically saying like you have to agree to cooperate on like on all these levels and have a common ideology, and it's like a party, and they're like, oh, but they can be separate parties. That's not the, you can't, this is like, you've created a gray area of what you what is allowed to be a grouping effectively.
So I would say that you just have in our version of it, you have a European party, which is a party of parties effectively, and then you have the national party.
Yeah,
it's theoretically possible for you to leave one or the other without leaving the other one, but chances are there'll be agreements being like made between these two institutions that might prevent that from happening.
Yeah,
that like being kicked out of civic platform, for example, means that you are also kicked out of the EPP, but theoretically it could happen that you would stay in the EPP.
you could join it with discussions of the EPP's leadership. I think the like the core bit of this of having the EU parties in the voting ballots has two benefits. One would be it increases awareness of like that party in the like general population. Like I talked to quite a few people who were like, so I was thinking of voting for this person who's like part of the Nordic Green Left. What do they stand, like what's their position on this? And was like, yeah, so that's not, because a lot of people don't know what the Nordic Green Left is and haven't heard of it, but otherwise won't be aware of this, or don't know who else is in the EPP and would make assumptions about who would obviously be in it, but are often wrong because there's a lot of weird outliers and stuff.
Yeah.
The S&D even more so, and ALDE even more so. It's kind of often surprising. You're like, oh, I didn't know which one they'd be in. I guess they're in ALDE, sure. one would increase awareness, but also I think it... There's like quite a few people who run as like independent MEPs, especially this is a problem in Ireland, or run as MEPs in parties that have are like up in the air about, oh, we might do whatever we want, like once the parliament starts, or tries to sell themselves as like outsiders who like aren't getting re-elected as MEPs. So you could have it that you have to have either the European party, both the European party you're currently a member of and running for, and then if you're not running for one and you were previously MEP, what European group party you were in when you left the European Parliament. So that would get away with like, you can't run as an independent if you were in the EPP's grouping for the entire last Parliament session.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it would technically be like, so again, it's, you would include both national and European Union, so that theoretical independent would be on the ballot as John Johnson, independent EPP.
Yeah, independent like, and EPP. Yeah, I think that'd be the way to do it.
Yeah, because it'd be independent on a national level, because there is theoretical possibilities. A good example again is Ireland, where you can be someone on the left in Ireland that supports United European Left, Nordic Green Left.
Mm.
But for national reasons, don't want to support Sinn Féin.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then people can look up and be like, ooh, but you joined Sinn Féin in the European Parliament. And then your response to that could be like, good job being more engaged in trying to look up people.
But like, yeah, you could still exist as a person who's like independent on a national, like there are reasons I haven't joined
indeed.
Sinn Féin, yeah, yeah. But there are reasons I've joined or Green Left. Yeah,
forces
yeah.
those clarifications as opposed to it being like a weird surprise later. Or just people never look into this, so they never know.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's the more common probably. Yeah, so I think those are two like easy reforms for the elections.
Yeah.
Moving on. This is a more drastic change, but I'm not sure if this is long. This is probably in between long term and short term.
Yeah. So this is to do with the Council of the EU and the European Council, which, if I remember correctly, we were very sick when we wrote this. These are two different institutions currently. Yep. Yes. Yep. One is the Council of the EU. That's the one where all the heads of government get together,
nope.
right?
No, it's the other one.
God damn it. All right. Council of the EU is the one where various ministers of the country rotate in and out depending on what legislation is being put forward.
Yep.
So if something financial is coming, then you're probably getting your like finance minister, your economic minister, chancellor of the exchequer, whatever the hell.
Yeah.
And then that would change if it was like a maritime law or like a internal affair, external affair. Yeah. And then you have the European Council, which is the heads of government all meeting together, like like once every quarter?
Yeah, something like that. Oh, more. Yeah, it varies.
Yeah, they meet occasionally, and they like kind of steer the EU theoretically. We would kind of get rid of both of those things in favor of replacing it with like an EU upper house,
mm-hmm.
European Senate, yeah. essentially.
We disagreed on this a lot at the time, but not like I think we came down on like a compromise solution.
We came down on something that I'm happy to put my name to it. Like, yeah, I think it's a decent system. So the idea is there is two seats per country. So at the current rate, that would be what? 56?
Yep.
56 seats. One is a permanent seat appointed like a cabinet position in each state. Mm-hmm. So like, basically you'd force each state to have like a European minister that takes this seat.
Yeah.
The second seat is for the head of state or the head of government.
Yep.
However, we recognize they can't always take that seat, so there is proxy voting allowed for, the European minister. This allows like a situation where the member states still have some involvement. They can kind of shift direction. Chances are these two people will vote on the same thing, on same policies, but there can be disagreements when, like, the European minister is from, like, a junior coalition partner and the, like, head of state is... But, like, if they... And they maybe might allow free voting on a certain issue, but then if, you know, that causes problems, then, you know, the government collapses in the member state and there's a snap election. There's processes for this already.
We think that would be fine.
Having like a clear direction in which the like member states can kind of say this is the European part, because the issue of like on the ideas that we talked about before, where like there's only one seat and it's the head of state, well, that gets into the problem of like, are the heads of state usually elected for their European policy?
Mm.
Like, we probably need someone who represents that, so that we have a clear understanding of each nation state's like agenda. On a European level.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we discussed would be, like, a big benefit of this would be having someone actually on the ground in a permanent semi-permanent capacity as your representative there, who's not, like, your commissioner who's given a specific job, but is the person who's supposed to be, like, overlooking the general stuff going on.
Yes.
And able to advise you on kind of, well, the thinking of the other, you know, representatives from the other countries is this.
And that, because the commissioners are given, like, portfolios and briefs in which they, like, handle, you know,
agriculture. They're head of a department of the commission bureaucracy. It's not...
Yeah. They're not necessarily... Because the whole statement of, like, a commissioner, although how true this is on, like, on the ground, is that they're meant to give up their, like, national preferences.
Yeah.
Which we can argue until the cows come home how like true that actually is in practice, but I mean, we can't actually remove national preferences from the institution entirely. There has to be like something to it where you have an avenue as a nation state to actually assert some concerns or direction.
Yeah, I think the main benefit of this, which I think we can't stress enough, is that there would no longer be two separate institutions with basically the same name, just council at the end or beginning of the name.
Which I'm assuming has to change when speaking French.
I just can't imagine. This is so confusing. It's so unnecessarily confusing. This and the groupings in the parliament, I think, is in place to intentionally dissuade people from looking into this.
Oh, God. All right, and that gets us into our long-term plans, yeah. Which are possibly vaguer, but sure.
We'd like to welcome in more refugees over time, yep. You know, figure it out.
in general, yeah, just if they've traveled through ridiculous shit to get here, they probably deserve to be here. More so than me, I just fell out of my mom. Well, no, that's probably undermining the work she did.
I feel like there's a middle ground where you're saying the refugees are good and not shitting on your parents.
Seems like unnecessary compromise.
Yeah.
We'll come back to this. No, but like, you get the point I'm making. Like, yeah. we're generally in favor of refugees coming, and yeah. Citizens' assemblies,
mm-hmm.
That's definitely the way to like draft an EU constitution, because a lot of this kind of increases democracy within the EU and kind of makes it more of an official body. So give it a constitution, have people have a lot of say over that.
Yeah, like a better version of what Macron wants.
Yeah, a better version. In general, like, also, I'd also kind of add that this is possibly a good rotating way of implementing a constitution as well as like constitutional or massive treaty change.
Yeah.
Yeah, is do it this way.
Yeah, because there is a historical problem with the treaty changes and new treaties getting appended to the EU, like, treaties and agreements, is that you then have, like, disagreements from a couple of... because they've pre-drafted something, and then they're like, say yes or no to it, and then some of the countries say no, and they're like, well, this is not what we... I thought we negotiated this, and they're like, no, we didn't like it. Or like Ireland historically has had referendums on it, and then you have that problem of like, well, you know, people are going to hijack this referendum for. Mm. But if they get people involved at the drafting stages more, you know, internally, then you don't necessarily have that problem in the same way. It's more something. Well, this is the consensus we all came up with. It's not a, it's not a thing that we went away, wrote, and brought back to you to vote on.
Yeah, that's true. Second or third in our long-term plans, this is me reaching out across the aisle to AKAKA in the CDU. We get rid of Strasbourg.
Yeah. And it's really only because we want to elevate AKK up to the chancellorship she deserved and worked hard for, so we should get some of her policies through. To make sure she gets the credit she deserves, and also to stick it to the French.
It's mostly sticking it to the French. The reason we put it into long term is, as Hugh correctly pointed out as soon as we brought this up, was like, what do we do with this building?
Yeah. And I think your initial answer was like, we could figure out something, like we could make a university, and was like, that'll take more than 5 years.
Yeah, because people... That is an interesting angle on the question of Strasbourg. Is like, what the fuck do we do with it?
Because you could let it decay, and then, like, as in, if it, like, honestly, if it went unused, you'd be shocked as to how quickly it would look like a piece of shit. I think any of the examples of like, I think any time there's an Olympics, and then the examples of that, the stadiums not being well used, or like the individual bits of it not being well used afterwards, is like things. When they're not being constantly tended to, especially buildings, do fall apart. It's like stuff goes wrong, and then you have massive problems.
So actually, yeah, this is Kieran's new radical proposal that I didn't brief Hugh on beforehand. Strasbourg just becomes the new home of the Winter Olympics every Winter Olympics.
Is it cold enough in Strasbourg for Winter Olympics?
We can make it work. No one wants the Winter Olympics anymore, except for a handful of. Horrifyingly corrupt countries
and Canada. So what you could do with it is just leave it empty and wait for an electrical fire to sort it out. But I just don't think that's the best. Like, I think we spent a lot of money building it. I think we should use it for something. And if it's been used for a parliament for a while, like until we figure out something else, sure, but there should be a long-term plan to get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah. And one that I think the other is real politic side of this is like, and something that like is at least an olive branch to the French.
Yeah, make it like the, I don't know, like
giant
a
international
Tron or something.
A giant international house of pancakes.
Do the French like pancakes?
Not the ones that they serve the international house of pancakes.
I didn't think so.
All right. Then we get into the EU Commission.
Mm.
Yeah. So this gets a bit more complicated because what we kind of landed on was make it more like a cabinet for a prime minister.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I think I want to kind of like something in between where you change the way commission president works and make it like a parliamentary system where instead of electing instead of doing what like basically we've recreated like a version of the French system with like the popular vote where the heads of government are the electorate and they just pick somebody who they want to be commission president and then the parliament has to approve it effectively. Mm. Which is odd, where they consider the parliament's candidate. Like, it's not... The Spitzen candidate process is not, like, no. What people actually want it to be. But then they also elect a head of the parliament who has, like, a less power, but is, like, the head of this body that has, like, a confusing amount of power.
Yeah.
Like, Tajani just doesn't seem to have much influence at all.
Yeah, no, it is the weird French system where everyone's like, oh, the president of France, and then everyone forgets there is a prime minister of France as well.
Who's just not important. So you could make it like a prime minister role where the parliament elects the head of the commission, and then I would keep the commissioner's system the way it is now, where they have to fill their cabinet with one person, for at least one person from every country.
Yeah, that is an interesting. I think there is something there where you can have like a cabinet that's appointed by. So I guess in the situation where you have like the EU commissioner is basically a prime minister, like the president of the commission is a prime minister. He comes along from like a three-party coalition. Let's say it's the last one where it's like ALDE, EPP, and SND. Mm. Do we have it so that like also while being from every country, they're also from the parties that make up the coalition?
No, I would keep it the way it is now, where the country gets to put people for it.
Fair enough. Okay.
Just because I think like there's the balance with reforming the EU where you don't want to wrest stuff away from national governments because the way it is now, even though like this election, it was great that the turnout was way up in most countries for the EU Parliament elections. And you can make, by changes like this, you can make them more important and then therefore you'd increase voter participation. You do still have the problem of like, well, you don't want to take too much power away from the national governments because people feel more like that they're their representatives, because they are the representatives at a lower level. So I think like something like naming your commissioner is like a pretty reasonable thing. And like the way it is now, the commission president can reject commissioner that gets sent. Like in practice, they don't really, but like the commission president has final say on their commissioners. It's not.
And they're also like approved by parliament. So.
Exactly.
There's a system there that could theoretically work.
Anyway, I think you could rename this the Imperial Senate and then have it the Emperor of Europe. It's problem solved.
Problem solved.
But it's like an elected office.
Yeah. The world's first elected emperor. And then the other one would be like national voting allowed for like all EU citizens, I think is something that needs to be done to make the system work. This is generally why I'm not a huge fan of a lot of like existing EU federalist movements, because they never seem to address this aspect like at all.
No,
it's kind of like implied, but
it's pretty ridiculous. Like you have this problem now that you live in Germany that you don't have a vote in the national elections, which is stupid at best because you pay taxes there. You're just not disenfranchised, effectively.
We've mentioned on this podcast that we're in favor of, like, immigrant suffrage just across the board, but, like...
Being immigrants,
yes. But, like, within the EU, it becomes particularly a farce.
Yes, yeah, it does, definitely.
You can't, like, say this is, a united political body and then not give people the right to vote in the elections that actually matter within this united political body.
Yeah, indeed. And also, I think, like, the one big thing you get out of it is that, well, the EU people who live in your country, who aren't from your country, but are from elsewhere in the EU, are almost certainly going to vote partially on EU issues. And that will make the EU-related stuff kind of bigger. Like, it'll increase its visibility and importance in national elections, which I think is a good thing, probably.
Yeah. The other side of that as well is that, like, a lot of the parties that have grown into power now that we as a podcast don't like, and I think our listeners don't like, which are, like, you know, Nigel Farage's ilk and Salvini's ilk and Le Pen's ilk, they got into power by basically, like, absolutely just dumping on EU immigrants.
Yeah.
The UK version of this in particular, like, the whole Romania-Bulgarian scare was, like, ridiculous. Yeah. And... that basically that tactic can't work in the long term if these people have a vote.
No.
Yeah, it becomes like way more like, well, sure, you can do it in the same way that, like, the British National Party can exist and try to run electorally, but, like, it doesn't really make sense to have a policy position of, like, dunking on people who vote for you. Yeah. People might say that's, like, cheating, but it's also not, so.
Oh, sorry, to clarify a point about the EU Commission thing, I think my suggestion was make it a Prime Minister thing where the Parliament picks somebody and then they get confirmed by the Senate, which is the body that we've created, which is, what, 56 seats of one, the head of state plus one other minister. So they have to get approved, but it's not a case of the council can pick somebody. It's a case of they have to approve somebody put forward by the Parliament, who's a member of Parliament, probably. Or not. They don't have to be a member of Parliament. They put whoever they want forward.
Yeah.
But right, that's the consensus. Yeah, anyway.
And that's the bonus episode. Oh my goodness.
It's bonus.
Bonus. So bonus. If you're listening to this a month after the fact because you're on the regular boring feed and you want it a month in advance, then sign up to the Patreon, you cool cats. Ooh, so cool.
Who's my Prime Minister?
Oh, God. And, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.